Jim Grant has a comment that says, right, in science and engineering, knowledge is cumulative, but in finance, it's cyclical, and cycles happen, and people lose sight of that fact, and therefore they think that what happens today is will be in perpetuity, and that gets reflected in price. And when those things change, the logical conclusion is, who wins then in the new situation with a different road that you made a turn on is different than the ones that were on the road that you were on.
And the explanation cannot be found in any mathematics, but it has to be found in investor psychology.
You know, the game in our kind of life is being able to recognize a good idea when you rarely get it. What is the old saying? The opportunity comes to the prepared mind.
Human nature hasn't changed in 25,000 years. I think volatility is terrific.
Lose money for the firm and I will be understanding. Lose a shred of reputation for the firm and I will be ruthless.
Welcome to AUM. On this show, we dive into the process, strategy, methods, and lessons from some of the world's best asset managers. We explore what it takes to produce outstanding investment outcomes in the complex adaptive system that is modern markets. I'm your host, Ryan Henderson, and today I have the pleasure of being joined by Bob Robotti. Bob is the president and chief investment officer of Robotti & Company, which he founded in 1983. In addition to his role as CIO, Bob also serves on the board of directors of several publicly listed companies in the Robotti & Company portfolio. I've personally followed Bob's career for some time, and I can say without hesitation that he is one of the most passionate and rigorous investors I know, and I think you'll be able to see that in today's discussion. Bob, welcome to the show.
Hi, Ryan. Great to be here. Thank you.
Let's start with, I guess, the genesis of your career. If I recall correctly, you kind of fell into the investing world in sort of a funny way. I guess it was initially sort of the accounting world. Can you tell us how you got into it?
Sure. So January was 50 years. I got an internship with a small accounting firm in New York, Pastorino Puglisi, 25 people. And the audit client they put me on to do my internship for the month of January 1975 was a firm called Tweedy Brown. And so when I graduate, start working for them in May, June, I'm working on the audit of Tweedy Brown. For the next 4 years, I was with the firm for three, 4 months of the year in terms of the various entities they had. So that was the very first client of the firm that I was exposed to.
When you audited Tweedy Brown, did you know who anybody at the firm was? Did you have any idea of, we look at them now as some of the names as kind of legendary people in the world of investing. Was that the case then as well?
It kind of was. Well, of course, the firm that I worked for, of course, knew who they were. And so therefore, however, I didn't know much about investing. I didn't know anything about investing. So therefore, the idea that I could understand kind of who they were and where they fit into the equation, you know, was probably pretty remote. The other thing I kind of point out is, you know, how fortuitous it was really in terms of timing. So again, unbeknownst to me, since I know nothing about investing, you know, in 1973 and 1974, you know, is the substantial market correction. So the Nifty 50 after phenomenally well, and of course, we all know that the Nifty 50 were these wonderful companies that had done extremely well, and they were one decision stocks. You bought it. It didn't matter the price you pay. You were going to make money. You were guaranteed to make money. So therefore, you know, suddenly those stocks had their comeuppance. And, you know, half of the stocks probably in the Nifty 50, you know, never saw that price ever again. And the other half took probably 10 years to get back to where they had been at that time. So, you know, I had a substantial correction. One decision stocks, great companies, however, valuations that reflected they were great and would continue to be great. And as I said, half of them, 10 years, 15, 20 years later, were gone. So they weren't great businesses because trees don't grow all the way to the sky, past the sky. There's a limit to what they do, and things happen, and competitive forces focus in on valuable businesses, and things can change. So the timing was such also that means that value investing wasn't the thing it became. So, right, that's the opening gun for the rotation and the beginning of the ascendancy of value. So whether it's Tweedy Brown, mutual shares, Mike Price, you know, you go through Ruane Cunniff, All the people in Graham and Doddsville, when Buffett speaks, you know, many years later at Columbia, all were people whose records started really to outperform at that time. So I happened to find out about investing at the inception of this rotation into value and its ascendancy. So a phenomenal opportunity in terms of timing for me.
Yeah, what a place to be at that time. What, I guess, how did you go from the auditing world to the investing? What was what sparked that interest?
Well, it's pretty easy, right? Here I am sitting in, you know, a little side office there, doing my picking and footing and my auditing and all that kind of work. But sitting in the room also, the Tweedy Brown was originally Tweedy Brown and Riley for decades. Joe Riley had retired from the partnership. And when he retired, he had a one-third partner. So he got one-third of every stock that Tweedy Brown owned. And right in the first John Train book, Tweedy Brown is identified as the pawnbrokers because they made markets at all these inactive small companies. And so and Joe owned all of them. And Joe would sit in the office and come in every day around noon and 1 o'clock. And at 6:30, you know, I'd be able to stop doing my ticking and footing and start to talk to Joe about investing. So therefore, not only did I know what Tweedy was buying and selling and I could see those things, but then I had the retired partner, founding partner of the firm, sitting in the room talking me through the what the concept is, what the logic is, why those things made sense, and how to think about those things. So, you know, for 4 years, I got this intensive look into what Tweedy was doing, and then I had someone translate it to me as to what it was, why it worked, and how it worked.
Looking back now, are you glad you started your career on the auditing side of things? Were there any lessons from that?
Absolutely. You know, it's also at the same time, it's the ascendancy, the efficient market, and you know, you can't outperform the market and all this intelligent thought about how to invest. If I had studied it in school, I would have gotten the dogma that they would tell you can't beat the market knows everything. It's a, you know, an accurate discounter of the future values. So therefore, I would have been polluted with these crazy ideas. Instead, I came in as a clean slate, and the only thing I knew was what Tweedy did and could understand what Tweedy did and could see how it would manifest and generate great returns. So yes, I was very fortunate in being a clean slate as opposed to having been polluted by bad ideas.
Okay, and as you mentioned, you have been in this value investing world for some time now. I think you said you just hit 50 years. Congratulations. How have the skills required to be a good value investor?
Well, Ryan, let me. So, I got my undergraduate degree working for 4 years and knowing the people at Tweedy and what Tweedy invested in, right? And then I went out to get an executive MBA program, right? Because then that same little accounting firm also audited a firm called Gabelli. So in 1980 to 83, I was the chief financial officer of Gabelli & Company. Now, Gabelli & Company in that period of time, you know, was 12 people. You know, Mario, when I started working for him at 80, managed $7 million. When I left to start my own firm in 83, it was only $77 million. Of course, he was, you know, had become clearly an identifiable phenomena. Right, Alan Abelson and Barron's and Kate Welling had discovered him, and he became a big thing because his performance was phenomenally interesting and good. And Gabelli at this time, his main business was a brokerage business because that was originally, he was a sell-side analyst. So every day he had his morning meeting and he'd go through his favorite stock idea that he'd share with the people at the firm. So that's what I say. For 3 years, I had an executive MBA program in value investing taught to me one-on-one by Mario Gabelli. And he paid me to attend class. I didn't pay him to attend the class. So not only do I have Tweedy's approach to investing and concepts, then I go to another value investor, and that's Gabelli, to see what he does, how he does things, how he thinks. And here I am in a more senior position. Here I am, the senior administrative person working with Mario every day, huge amounts of time, spending, and a time when it's a small firm. It's only 12 people. So everybody spent a lot of time with him. So, you know, so I had those two introductions that have been invaluable to me. Sorry.
Yeah, it's a pretty phenomenal education and time to be going through it.
Yeah.
Looking back today with the way, I guess, the investing world has evolved and looking back to those early years, let's say the early years of Robotti and Company, 1983, maybe through the mid 80s, have the skills required to be a good value investor changed at all?
No, I don't think so. Actually, in many ways, they're probably just as easy today. And because I do think if you do bottom-up individual analysis on companies, it's not that hard. I think there are a multitude of companies that are attractively priced. You know, on an absolute basis, that's absolutely true. and obviously on a relative basis too. So I think you could do it. Now, do you make money? Does your stock perform in that period of time? Is it outperform the market? Well, if you're talking about 23 and 24, to outperform the market's a, you know, somewhat of a Herculean task. So probably not likely to. So therefore, are you a success? Maybe you're a success because you're only up 20%, so you pick some stocks. So, but I do think there's a, and I have that experience, right? There are 14 people who work here, and I must have three people walk in every day and say, here's a really cheap stock, this is why we should own it. And I think the investment thesis they have is compelling. So from my experience, the people here, who have the right framework to think about how to think about investing, regularly come to me with compelling investment ideas.
Okay, let's dig into that process a bit. So on this show, we try to get sort of a grip on each firm's investment process. And I know there's a number of analysts at Robotti & Company, one that I know well, and I'm curious what the process looks like for them and for you. If an analyst is presenting a new idea, what are you looking for in that pitch?
So I'm a terrible manager. I don't manage people. I'm looking for people who are self-motivated, who can think on their own, who generate ideas. And those ideas can be in things that I would not have thought of. And, because I have certain core competencies I regularly go back to, and, you know, there's opportunities for me to invest in those spaces, but other people think differently. And in my experience, having done this for as long as I have, you know, I don't have any key to this is the magic formula. And if it isn't that, I don't want to do it. And obviously doing something a little different than what I've done that is intelligent, well thought, and the valuation attractive is something that I find healthy for me. And so therefore, I welcome the opportunity to, my door is closed right now, but it's almost always open and people wander in all the time. And so, that's the process here. It is very, you do it, you think about it, you tell me why it makes sense. Although we generally think in the same context about valuation really does matter, why the business is interesting, what is the business, understanding what the business is, and therefore that enables you to therefore have some view on not only what the current earnings are, but what the earning outlook is, and therefore present value of the future cash flows of the business determine if the stock's a cheap stock or not.
All right. For yourself then, do you spend more time on researching new ideas or maintenance research?
Well, it's an interesting question. What's the definition of maintenance research? Because maintenance research, like maintenance capital, sounds like if you don't do it, you fall apart. And so therefore, maintaining means you're just maintaining the position. I spend a lot of time on the companies that I know. I spend a lot of time on the industries that I know. Now, of course, that itself has its recycling process. The industry I may know, and which is the company that's well positioned to outperform, changes over time. So therefore, maintaining a knowledge of an industry isn't necessarily maintaining an investment and just it. It really continues to inform views on A, yes, how the capital is invested, but B, where there are new opportunities and what might be compelling today, and therefore, what changes you might make.
Has serving on boards of the companies that you guys have, do you think that's made you become a better investor in any way?
I think that clearly, Buffett said it long before I did, the idea that, the kind of the closer you are on a board to the business itself and understanding the business, it better informs your view in terms of how to think about businesses, how to think about that business, but to think about the competitive landscape, the industry it's in and all those things. So, and of course, the way you understand a business is there's different knowledge and information you get about the complexity of the business. And of course, sitting on the boards also does remind me that, frequently the old phrase is, it's like working in a sausage factory, right? So you see everything. And so therefore, and of course, everything's not perfect and wonderful in almost in any business, I would guess. So therefore, you understand all of those aspects. So A, it forms your view in the company. B, it gives you information about the competitive landscape and other opportunities that potentially kind of come along with increased knowledge and understanding of those other businesses' dynamics. And of course, C, specific to the company, I am sitting in a room with a number of other people who are determining the CEO of the company, evaluating the CEO, helping the CEO think through strategic ideas and the allocation of capital. And that's the reason I go on the boards, is I think that there's a long-dated opportunity to work along with the rest of the board members and management to maximize value and kind of how to think about that and how to have a, you know, longer term view, right? Because the market and investors constantly shorten your horizon and make you think about things in the short term. And, you know, what's the rage today? And therefore, you know, Wall Street tells you this is what you have to do. And yet that's not the right thing to do for the next 3 to 5 years. And, you know, I'm going to own the stock for the next 3 to 5 years. And I think our owners want to think that way and don't get distracted by the siren song of looking for something that seems as if it kind of makes sense in the short term, but is not the right path.
If, let's say, a new idea comes across your desk and it's not a company brought to you by an analyst, but one that, you know, maybe a friend, someone in your network mentions a company to you, maybe it's mentioned through competitors of a company you already know. How long does that due diligence process for you typically take? Is it depend on the industry? Are there some where it takes one 10K and you instantly have a grasp on it? Or is it sometimes longer than that?
No, generally it takes a little bit longer time, right? Looking at something quickly is hard to really have a fully formed view on. And so generally I am a slow learner. And so therefore it takes me over time to kind of have some comfort and appreciation. That said, there are situations where that's not the case. You know, the facts happen to line up. My understanding and knowledge happens to line up. The valuation happens to line up. So sometimes it can happen pretty quickly. So the answer is it depends.
Okay. Are there any industries, because I looked through the body and company portfolio and it's all over the place, from industrials to home builders to some tech companies in there as well. Are there any industries that are a no-go for you that you avoid altogether?
Well, yeah, because that's a limited number of companies we are interested in. So most industries aren't in there. And so and that's an absolute length of time it takes to do. It's an industry we don't know. You know, it takes much longer to us to get an understanding as the business, therefore to have the comfort to be able to do that. Although we generally do look for businesses that are beaten up and out of favor. And frequently those might be industries we really haven't historically invested in. And therefore it is a process to therefore get to learn the business. And we think it makes sense to do that because, probably things, if they're going through difficult times, don't correct overnight. And problems persist. And so therefore it's worthwhile to spend the time and effort and look into it more deeply.
Yeah. And touching on that point, in a recent letter, you wrote that you have, quote, a recurring pattern of investing in businesses that are in industries experiencing difficult financial conditions. And you likened it to that rubber band analogy. Can you explain that analogy a bit? And why do you find attractive opportunities in those circumstances?
So not only are they going through difficult times, there's a good chance that the earnings are non-existent. And so, the key metric that people value businesses as earnings multiples, free cash flow. And if free cash flow is like negative even, you know, then what's the business worth? And so those stocks perform poorly. And, the poorer it performs, the bigger the discount. So A, valuation potentially becomes attractive. B, what we think is having invested in cyclical businesses in difficult times in the past, you know, there's a, you know, economics 101 really does work. And that is that people stop investing. People shut businesses. People consolidate. People right-size. They make a lot of adjustments. And so therefore the business itself starts a cathartic process in correcting itself. And the industry frequently then also downsizes. People exit the business. So the competitive landscape changes. So that's what it is. You could buy a business for far less than what it would cost to build that business because nobody in their right mind would build that business because it isn't making money. And so therefore capital is being retracted. So A, the process of the company and its competitive situation and its earnings profitability, and especially if someone's a good manager, a differentiated product has certain attributes that mean the downturn actually accelerates their opportunity over time to get returns. So did they buy something when valuations were depressed and therefore expanded the business countercyclically? And I mean, again, earnings power of the business is enhanced. So those things are all things that we're regularly looking for. And the rubber band is, I'm sure, the longer it takes for a business and the longer it stays bad and the more that happens, the more cathartic, because more people leave the business, more capitulation, both that's internal to the business and the allocation of the capital, the scale of the business, and it's also the stock market, because the stock market says, this is a value trap. They're on the stake forever. Yeah, they used to make money. You'll never make money again. Get me out of it. So the market helps out because it further discounts. The business continues to correct. And that's what I pointed out. So, one of the companies that we had good fortune, good result with was Builders First Source, a distributor to home builders. And then from that, we saw another company, and that was BMC, in which we then invested in BMC. So that industry, right, home building went from 1.7 million homes when they were giving away free money and people were buying homes that, you know, weren't going to be owned by somebody who was an owner, couldn't own the home. And then they had overbuilt, and so therefore it took a decade, really, to absorb the overbuilding. And so therefore, it just went down, and then it went down further, and it went down further. So it took longer, and then the recovery was really slow. And so in that process, I do look in 2015, so 09 starts the process, 11 is probably the bottom of the market. In 15, you start to have recovery. When these businesses recover, it's not never a straight line thing. You know, goes up two steps and then pulls back a little bit. And then investors said, that's it. It's the end of the cycle. Get out. And so the capital exacerbates the movement in the business, and it's not stair step, but progression in a direction, and like gives all kinds of opportunities. But in 2015, that industry had two phenomenal things. One is stock building supply had gone public. It was control was seized by Gores Group out of bankruptcy in 2008, 2009. They were very clever financial people who bought a business in distress and then shortly thereafter sold off a bunch of the assets that raised capital that paid off their investment in the business so that the equity they owned was a free call. As the business is recovering, they're looking to monetize. So they took the company public, but the business really wasn't good and the stock then languished. So they're looking around, how do I do? How do I monetize my investment? So they went to BMC, which had also gone through bankruptcy, which the largest shareholder, we were the number two shareholder, but the number one was Davidson Kempner, who again was a distressed investor, bought it cheaply, owned it, was also looking for an exit. So therefore approached them about merging those two businesses. In the meantime, Builders First Source is this other company that I thought was the perfect match. So I said, before we talk to stock, let's go talk to the builders. But what happened then was the number one guy in the business is ProBuild. ProBuild is owned by the Johnson family, Fidelity. And they've been writing checks, $100 million every year to keep the business afloat. So 2015, they came to him again and said, yeah, business is still tough. I need another $100 million. So the Johnson family said, that's it. I'm out. No more. Sell this thing. I don't want to own it anymore. So capitulation, you know, when the business had started to recover, but it was still difficult times. So they put it up for sale and Builders First Source then leaped at that, right? They're going to buy the number one guy before they're going to merge with us, the number three or four guy. And so they levered up to do that and it worked well. And we then merged with the stock building supply. So that consolidation, had the business recovered a year or two earlier, the Johnsons wouldn't have been writing a check for another $100 million. They would have stayed in the business, you know, would have stayed as fragmented as it kind of historically had been. Instead, you know, that kind of was the last, that was the next to last, because then you had one and two combining with three and four. And then eventually 2 years later, the two of them combined again. So that consolidation kind of only happened because the recovery took longer than people expected and wanted and didn't want to persist through that process. So the rubber band got stretched awful far. And then eventually when it started to come back, created a whole bunch of opportunities. But it also, if it had not stretched that far and stayed bad for that long, those opportunities would not have manifested. And the outcome that what you have today would not have been, it still would have been a much more fragmented business than the consolidated business it is today. So that's an example.
From the looks of it, you guys own a number of companies that are in cyclical industries. And to use that, to stay on that rubber band analogy, what are some of the mistakes you see management teams make at the bottom of the cycle, and also mistakes that they might make at the top of the cycle?
Well, at the top of the cycle, everybody spends too much money, invests too much capital. You know, potentially there's a real risk because everything facilitates that. Money is available to you and you can do things and, you know, your perspective is warped. And it's odd. It's an odd management that understands the risk associated with being at the high end of a cycle, which is interesting, though, because like one of the first investments You know, there was a company in 1976 that bought Atwood Oceanics, an offshore drilling company. And it's a great example of what happens when you are smart and thoughtful and a countercyclical investor. Because what happened was they were the smallest of all the public offshore drillers. And the end of the 70s and the 80s, everybody was building new rigs, borrowing money. Money was available cheap and easy. And buy these wonderful pieces of equipment that could do things that others can't. And it's the next round, and it's the second generation, the third generation. So you want to own the next and the biggest and the biggest. And Atwood didn't do that. Atwood was controlled by Hemrick & Payne. So Hemrick & Payne had been in this business forever. Hemrick & Payne had lived through the Depression. And the people at Hemrick & Payne who controlled the board said, we're not doing that. When that spent, there's just too much risk. There's too much euphoria here. And so when the business fell apart, right, it had no debt and $40 million in cash. And the rest of the industry went bankrupt three times in the 80s. So therefore, you had recurring bankruptcies because people were called in, did spend the capital, did graft it, as opposed to Hemrick & Payne, didn't do that. And Atwood is the one that clearly survived and was in a much better position. And so having seen what they did and experienced that was, you know, informative for me as how you can totally not listen to what Wall Street was telling you, have your own view, understand you're in a cyclical business, understanding and putting capital to work at that point is a very risky proposition, and didn't do it. And therefore stayed out of they sat down and they didn't want to play musical chairs because they know how musical chairs ends, and they didn't want to end. So, you know, that you can see that you could do that right thing, but that's a really difficult process. That's an exception as opposed to the rule. But on the other side of the equation, you know, what you can do at the bottom of the cycle, you know, obviously anything you're forced to do to pare back, to shrink the business, you know, make be a survival technique, but isn't clearly not optimal. But, you know, are you in a position to be able to do something? How do you figure something out to do? That's a difficult process too, but there are people who can be successful. And that's one of the key things we look for is like, who's got a company in its position and a combination of balance sheet management owners, because clearly what you're looking for too is probably someone, there is a control shareholder who it is his capital and he's committed to the business and understands the opportunity and therefore can seize it and figure ways to be opportunistic, which you have to be creative because it's not easy to do that, right?
Makes sense. And I would imagine investing in some of these cyclical industries, it takes sort of a macro view on what you imagine the industry is going to look like. And I believe you guys have a term around the firm called grassroots macroeconomics. Can you explain what that is? And can you also elaborate on why you think it's important to have a view of the macro situation overall?
What we're saying is, you know, by knowing the individual dynamics of a business, identifying companies that we think actually have managements that understand those things, so therefore kind of can inform us as to how to think about the business. Those are critical elements in identifying, A, what's going to be successful, but understanding the dynamics. Now, what we don't get is we don't get the timing, right? And so therefore, and we don't know when that happens. And so therefore, the process of correction is one that is uncertain. And so therefore, you have to be judicious with being aggressive, right, in terms of doing things and what's the timing to do things and having an appreciation, understanding what to do.
Makes sense. I was listening to a conversation you had recently, and you mentioned and this is kind of shifting to the market overall, you mentioned that time horizons overall were shrinking, and whether that's from more news being fed today, the accessibility of information is so much easier. I guess, is there anything that you do in particular to sort of eliminate the noise, or have you gotten to the point where you know when or when not to care? Hey listeners, before we move on, I want to mention the company that actually runs the show. AUM is a FinChat podcast. FinChat.io is the fastest growing equity research platform on the internet. Powered by AI, FinChat offers institutional grade financial data on all stocks globally. And the best part is the data extends well beyond the generic financial metrics. You know all those company specific metrics that you track on your own spreadsheets? I'm talking about Amazon segment revenue, Netflix's paying subscribers by region, Chipotle's comp sales, Uber's active customers, Spotify MAUs, FinChat tracks all of it so you don't have to. If those numbers matter to you, I recommend checking out the platform. All new users get 2 weeks free of FinChat Pro automatically, so head on over to finchat.io and check it out. Now let's get back to the interview.
So that is the problem today. There's just too much information. And to be able to put contextually understand it, that's one of the reasons why it's really good to try to have an understanding as to what the business is and therefore what the intermediate to long-term likelihood of something happening is. And that's what we're saying. We don't get the timing right, but you know, it's easier to identify what's going to happen over 5 years than what's going to happen in the next 6 months, right? And especially there's a combination of factors all doing that. So that's generally some of our ideas in terms of what happens. But we still say that. We say information, you know, if you want to outperform the market, right, there's three ways you outperform the market. You have to have an advantage, right? It's a behavioral edge. So that's a critical part of what we do. We're investing in businesses that are cyclical and out of favor. And we know that more likely they go down versus they go up. So we're open to that idea. I'm going to lose half my money. That's perfectly fine on a mark-to-market basis because I don't think I've lost it. On an investment basis, and the company becomes cheaper and whatever else. The second one is information edge. And of course, that's what we do actually think. We have an information edge that ties into the behavioral edge. That is, the information I'm looking at is, what's the impact in the business in the next 3 to 5 years? And frequently, information that's negative for the next month, quarter, year is positive for the next 3 to 5 years, right? Because continued reduction in prices means that someone else is going to shut capacity. There's more that leaves the market. So yes, that negative news flow on the short term means there's a more cathartic process on a medium to longer term. Therefore, the opportunity set probably is getting better if you've got the right company that's a survivor and someone who's going to be opportunistic in that environment. So keeping which pieces of news to get, and I think that's really not as hard as it seems to be, because that's what it is. It's like it's just asking the question, okay, so what's the impact of this on the next 3 to 5 years? What impact is this going to have longer term on the business? Not what's the short term impact of it, which is going to be the bulk of the flow. And frequently, right, negative news is positive news, right? Negative short term news is positive for the medium to longer term outlook for the business of that company, most likely.
You've also said recently that you believe the next decade will belong to stock pickers and not the index. Why is that?
Valuation matters, and there's a significant number of companies we think the valuations are extremely interesting and compelling, and obviously those are in stocks that have performed well, because if they did, they'd have larger market caps, and if they had larger market caps, they'd be higher weighted in the index and more capital would flow into them. So there's capital that, you know, flows into and flows out of, you know, and we all know that the concentration of the companies that have been done well, that therefore have great performance, and of course, you know, the point we would make today is, and stocks aren't bought or sold by individual analysis and selection to say, this is a good company, I want to own more of it, and this is not a company I want to own. It really is the flow of funds is predicated on something else. Is it in an index? What index did it add to? Who got kicked out of? You know, get kicked out, it goes down, got added, goes in, up. What algorithm is following and whatever. So the flow of capital is not predicated on stock analysis. And so therefore, that gives an increased likelihood you got a disparity between price and value. And therefore, you know, we do think that that means there's a plentiful number of companies where you can identify dynamics that should give really good absolute returns. And we also think that on a relative basis, that probably when you've concentrated down a group that have clearly better valuations because they've had great records, which the Nifty 50 did, they were wonderful companies that had valuations that reflected that fact. Things happen and things change. In the meantime, you have another group of companies down here. And that's part of what happened with value, right? Value back in 1975, there were a lot of cheap stocks. And value investors owned those cheap stocks because they did bottom-up fundamental analysis on companies. And they own inexpensive securities. I think that that is the predominant situation today. What I also think is that even in the Magnificent Seven, there's a good chance in the next 10 years that you got to pick the right ones, that they're not all going to do the same thing, right? Because there used to be what was it called? There was FANG stocks, and now it's the Magnificent Seven. So over time, somebody changes who's one of those companies, and maybe over time, a couple of those change. And so there's some of those are going to do well, and some of them probably aren't. And I have no capability to know that. But someone who looks at them intensively probably can do that. So I think someone who is picking the right companies is actually going to outperform the index. So I think valuation is the thing that will eventually deliver performance. I also think there's rotation in economic activity, right? You know, so what's the best company today? What's the best industry today? Over time, industries that have been the best and companies that are the best almost always rotate. And so there's plenty of things. And in addition, underlying economics. So, you know, we lived through a long period of time where inflation was really low, therefore interest rates were really low. And, you know, there are certain companies that benefit from that kind of economic environment. And yet if that economic environment, things are cyclical, right? Jim Grant has a comment that says, right, in science and engineering, knowledge is cumulative, but in finance it's cyclical. And cycles happen and people lose sight of that fact. And therefore they think that what happens today is and will be in perpetuity. And that gets reflected in price. And when those things change, there's the logical conclusion is who wins in the new situation with a different road that you made a turn on is different than the ones that were on the road that you were on.
Makes sense. Why do you think energy-intensive companies have a long-term competitive advantage?
So it's energy-intensive businesses in North America have a competitive advantage. Right, and that's because energy costs in North America are significantly discounted from the rest of the developed world. And that is because there's an overabundance of natural gas here that's more than we possibly consume internally. And that's a persistent asset and advantage that North America has that I think easily goes through the next decade and therefore longer than that. So if you're an energy intensive business and therefore you're using natural gas here in North America, versus using oil or natural gas or coal somewhere around the world, there's a substantial difference. So, you know, is natural gas price a quarter, 20% of what it is in most of the world? And so therefore, if energy is a key part of the cost of goods sold, you've got excess margin because the price is probably set by the marginal high cost producer someplace else. So he sets the price, you have a much lower cost because your natural gas costs a fraction of what their naphtha cost or what their gas costs or what their coal costs. So that means there's excess returns. And that's what we think is, you know, one of the phenomena in the last 2-3 years, people have been talking about reshoring to America. And what we think reshoring to America in large part is industrial businesses who have a competitive advantage because of the low cost of energy. And so that's the rotation of who's positioned in the right place, what are the economic dynamics, who's going to be the beneficiary. And that's what we think is that the pricing is set by somebody else, so there's excess margin and realizable and below-cost energy jurisdiction, and that's America. For whatever it's worth, I say America, because I do include Canada in that, and you know, because that is the resource base in America. In North America includes a huge resource base in Canada that's much lower cost than even in the United States. And so I do think that's part of the equation that makes for an interesting investment.
Sort of on that topic, as we're recording this, there has been a lot of noise and news, I should say, made about tariffs. With a lot of exposure to industrials, how do you think about that? What impact might that have overall on the U.S. economy?
Yeah. I think the fact that energy costs in North America are competitively advantaged will be the fact in 3-5 years' time that really is the most relevant thing. And the tariffs really don't affect much where you're going to produce it, where the resource is. And so it will help you potentially because it may discount stocks because there would be the fear and concern about things. But what the outcome is, so, you know, one of the things the administration has said is, you know, drill, baby, drill. You know, we're going to increase production 3 million barrels in America. The economics clearly argue against that for a multitude of reasons. And so, you know, does that come to pass? I have a hard time believing that possibly something that really could happen. So it may drive stock prices and may make for headlines, but the economic reality is oil companies aren't going to go out, especially as oil price gets weaker here, go out and spend all the money they need to spend to somehow bring on 3 million extra barrels of oil, which therefore reduce the price of what they're already selling. So they're not going to commit economic suicide, and the government's not going to drill those wells. And the opportunity set is also limited too. You know, what's available in the United States is it's a finite amount of oil that really can be produced economically. At the end of the day, you know, economics will constrain pretty much all activity in North America.
Okay, I've got, I guess, two wrap-up questions here. First one would be, what, when you join a board of one of your companies, I guess, first question is typically, is that typically something you do once you've owned it for a little while, or is that something you try to do, like, you know you're going to do as you're sort of starting the position? And then the follow-up there would be, what kind of value are you trying to provide? Why do you want to be on the board typically?
So historically, every board we've gone on is a company we already own a significant position in. And the reason we go on to the boards is, A, we think there's a long-term opportunity, because being on the board does create restrictions, limitations, and, you know, does have some negative aspects to it. But that's what we're saying is, gee, you know, we don't trade around stocks really anyway. So the short-term trading in and out of a stock is not something we would do. So therefore, we don't lose the capability to do that. At times, we may want to buy stock, and therefore, we lose that opportunity. But instead, to be sitting in the room to, A, understand the investment we have and how the business works better, clearly makes us a better investor. But it also, talk to the management of the company and ask them how they think about things. And therefore, potentially, along with the rest of the board, be part of a process that helps them think more clearly about where the opportunity sets are, where the risks are, how to think about the business, how to allocate capital. So they have input into that process. We think that there's reasons to believe that you can accelerate and increase the amount of value the company can be create by having a seat at that table and talking to the people and being involved with the selection of the new CEO, if there's reason why you change the CEO or someone retires, and how capital is allocated. So,
okay, last question for you. What advice would you give to someone entering the investment industry today?
So we were down in Alabama recently, Tuscaloosa, University of Alabama. John Hines was a professor in a program there, and it's all teaching value investing, right? So a student came up to me and said, do you have internships? Do you hire people? I said, we do, but we're full for the summer. But, you know, like, tell me about a company that you own and why you own and how you think about the company. And what he says is, well, actually, I have the money I have is in a passive index fund. And you know, I've done well on it because I put $15,000 in and it's now worth $19,000. And so I said, well, the first thing you should do is to sell that index fund, because what have you learned about that? Instead, you should go buy some stocks, and hopefully you'll lose money in those stocks, because what you'll learn from that is more important. So you have to be investing. You have to be doing that. You have to be taking the risk. And because, let's face the facts. So if you're 15, went to 19, that's not going to change your life ever. And so therefore, you know, making money is not the object of your investing as a younger person, right? The object of your investing is to learn. Right, because the value of that education compounds multiples. And so therefore, that's what you should be doing. So do analysis, buy some stocks, find out if you're right, find out if you're wrong. With the ones you're wrong on, do less of that, and the ones you're right on, do more of that. So, you know, learning by doing is the way to learn. And there's no better way to do it. And, you know, an index isn't going to teach you anything. And other than maybe that you think you can make money, that you think you're really good at coin flipping and therefore know how to flip coins, and maybe not.
Yeah, the expression I've heard is life's too short to index, and it feels like the value you get, the best lesson, the best teacher you could have is owning stocks and kind of being on that journey along with the company as well, especially in those early years. That is going to do it. I guess any other thoughts, Bob, before we wrap things up?
Nope.
Okay. Great. All right. Well, appreciate the time. That's going to do it for today. Brian. Thank you, everyone, for tuning in to this episode of AUM. I'd like to remind listeners that the AUM podcast is for informational and educational purposes only. All opinions expressed on the show by guests or hosts are solely their own and do not constitute formal advice or a recommendation. Thank you to Bob for joining the show, and thank you all again for listening. We'll see you next time.
Thank you, Ryan. All the best, everyone. Bye-bye.